We're already smashing concepts, Cadell, and you're coming right in the right perfect time.
Yeah, we're busy like killing
neologisms. Yeah, we were like kind of venting, you know, we space, what a silly word is that? You know, a container or hub, what, it's like all these silly words that don't mean anything.
Yeah. I'm with you.
And so now you're coming in and now you have the space and the container and hub and the we space to smash.
Are we in a we space right now? Is this a we space between the three of us?
We're in a news space,
right? Actually. Well, I like being in a particle collider of concepts. So,
right. Yeah.
So first, like, how are you doing, Cadell? And you know, we invited you here to talk about your course, A Creed, to talk about Lacan.
Yeah, no,
it was something both me and Tom kind of know, like through secondhand reading, but we don't know his work
through osmosis,
directly.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of hoping you'll educate us a little bit on Lacan and tell everybody about your new course.
Yeah, thank you for that. Yeah, some secondhand Lacanian smoke.
Yeah.
I'm doing well. I mean, I've mostly actually the course was originally supposed to be starting middle of July, and I pushed it back to the start of September. So I gave myself the summer to sort of take a break from teaching. And that's been great, and just enjoying the summer. But yeah, the course on Lacan's Ecrit will start September 3rd. I'm open to talking about anything related to Lacan, psychoanalysis, philosophy. Yeah, whatever you guys are interested in.
Well, just give us a brief introduction to the Ecrit. What is this piece of work and why is it important?
Yeah, no, good question. I'll say it is, at least in France, recognized as one of the most important texts written in the 20th century. I think it made some very famous list of like the greatest books of the 20th century. And I think it's widely recognized as one of the most innovative psychoanalytic works after Freud, also in the 20th century. And in many sense, it's interesting, you know, because how much real innovation has occurred in the field of psychoanalysis outside of, let's say, Lacan, Jung, a couple other crucial figures, but not much has happened in psychoanalysis itself, it seems to me, in the 21st century. It seems like most of the innovation in the 21st century as it relates to psychoanalysis is coming from philosophy, not internal to psychoanalysis itself. But the Ecrit, as it's situated in Lacan's career very quickly, so of course, it's one of two major styles of Lacan's work. He very famously, I think it was for 30 or 35 years, was giving yearly seminars, all oral teaching. And he focused on oral teaching for the most part. And he would attract in the latter half of his seminars. In the early half of his seminars, it was very small niche audiences. In the latter half of his seminars, he was attracting the whole town. He was attracting crowds. Right? He was attracting like people from all walks of life as well. And increasingly, he was attracting fewer and fewer psychoanalysts. Funny enough. And he was attracting more and more mathematicians and philosophers and sociologists and, you know, people from all walks of life, basically. But the Ecrit is his other form of work, which is his writings, of course. And the writings are often seen as more technical. They're seen as elitist. They're seen as even more obscure than the seminars. So they have this aura about them of a sort of dense impenetrability. And I would like to change the discourse on that, because I think that, I mean, I'm hoping the course goes a long way to making the Ecrit intelligible. And I would say that the dominant theme that runs in the Ecrit, now, interestingly, there's three major periods of Lacan's career. And it goes in this order. It starts with the imaginary, its middle phase is the symbolic, and the last phase is the real. And the Acree is published in the 60s, which is smack dab in the middle of his career. So its focus, its emphasis is on the symbolic. And you get this sense right from the beginning of the work that Lacan's job is trying to, and this is, I think, what the Acree is organized towards, even effectively, emotionally. He's upset that the institutions of psychoanalysis have, in his mind, drifted into the imaginary and have lost their effectiveness as a consequence of that. And so he makes a lot of emphasis on the whole field of psychoanalysis is only relevant if we keep it in the field of speech, if we keep it in the field of language. If we lose it to the imaginary, all effectiveness will be lost. Basically, no capacity to really stay true, in Lacan's words, to the discovery of the Freudian unconscious. And of course, what orients his entire work is the return to Freud. And so throughout the Acree, he's emphasizing, reading these secondhand literatures, and this is also very true to Philosophy Portal, basically reading secondhand literature is not the same as reading the primary source. And so he says basically a lot of Freudian psychoanalysis has been watered down by secondhand literature, and that people aren't actually reading the original literature and they actually don't understand the original use of the concepts. And so he's trying to really go back to the drawing board, go back to the original ideas that Freud was developing, the radicality, and in some sense, the emotional negativity, the affective negativity of what psychoanalysis is trying to do. And trying to, I mean, in some sense, it's like a rescue mission. He's saying that psychoanalysis at the time in the 60s, in its popularity, actually had at the same time watered itself down to the point of ineffectiveness. And so that might give you a little bit of the picture of where Lacan's going, and we could talk a little bit more maybe about what does it
mean. Can you give an example, like what kind of concepts was he kind of deconstructing or like zoning in on in the imaginary? Like, do you have some concrete examples?
Also, just going back, absolutely. I'm sorry to interrupt, Tom, but I just want to know what clearly the difference between the imaginary and the real as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so let me just start with the concepts was, and I think we all know in some sense was the way in which Freud's concepts have become in some sense popular speech. Right. Like we all know the ego, the superego, the id. There are a lot of even concepts like transference or the instinct, the way in which psychoanalysis uses that. Lacan was basically saying that the way Freud was using these concepts was derived from a very technical, precise use, basically one from the clinic. And the work in the clinic. Whereas when these concepts became popular knowledge, they lost their original technical understanding and they became watered down by in some sense. What Lacan's saying here is very dialectical in the sense that the very success of Freud's concepts was in some sense their downfall. Because they were so well integrated, because they were so well accepted. And he also goes on a lot about how other fields of the human sciences, like sociology, mainstream psychology, and other fields, had started to reappropriate or misappropriate some of these Freudian concepts. And so a lot of what Lacan's trying to do is to reclaim the centrality of psychoanalysis for what he's trying to approach as a...
Isn't that always the case?
Sorry?
Isn't that always the case or often the case that these concepts, when they get into the mainstream, that they lose their original meaning or like big chunks of their original meaning?
Yeah, I mean, I think you see it a lot in physics. I think you probably see it a lot in biology. Off the top of my head, I mean, I think if you were to ask a professional physicist, if the number of times they hear the concept of entropy abused or misused,
Sure.
For example. So I think in popularization, there is always this risk inherent to the field. I think the difference with psychoanalysis as it regards to, let's say, the field of physics is that there's almost no harm done if there's a popular misunderstandings of like the concept of entropy or the, you know, the differences between Newtonian, Einsteinian gravity, because as long as the specialists know what they're talking about and know what they're doing, their experiments are going to go through just fine. It's not going to be interrupted by misunderstandings in popular culture. But that's not so much the case in psychoanalysis, because psychoanalysis object is, in some sense, the human subject. It's not an inhuman object. It's a human subject. And also what also concerns Lacan is he's, and this might be interesting for maybe particularly Sweeney, is that it seems like a problem that might come up in mystical circles as well in regards to guru figures or enlightenment figures, is that Lacan's incredibly concerned about whether or not psychoanalysts even exist, meaning he's concerned with the training of psychoanalysts.
Mm-hmm.
And he's concerned with how do we even know if someone's ready to be a psychoanalyst? And he's also concerned with all of the institutional pressures that go into, oh, you've got a 4-year degree, so now you're a psychoanalyst. Like, how do we know you're actually a psychoanalyst, like ready to be a psychoanalyst? And there's very specific things he's working through there that sort of seem to me to indicate the incredible difficulty in cultivating the type of effective disposition.
Oh, that's really interesting. I was talking, we were speaking before you came on about somebody named Andrew. Are you there, Cadell? Do we lose you?
I am. Just one second. I'm listening.
Okay. I was talking to a guy named Andrew Cohen, who you might have heard of, who was a big guru, let's say, you know, around the time of Ken Wilber. He was Ken Wilber's best friend. And his whole community kind of collapsed. And then he was sort of forced by his students to go to do psychoanalysis. And he was talking about that. He was telling me yesterday, we were walking around in the Forest Fund, but he was telling me that what kind of healed him when he talked to the psychoanalyst was the human contact. Like he just needed somebody. He needed somebody to connect with, because he was, you know, he was kind of destroyed. Right. His life was sort of like in pieces. And he said that the actual content of the psychoanalysis didn't mean anything to him, but the contact with the person was what kind of healed him in the first stage. And then he said he went to see Augustus Masters, and they were doing all of this sort of, they were doing all of this kind of emotional work all the time. And he said that was good as well. But that wasn't really there was a limit to that as well, because it was just like you're in the jungle with a machete working, always processing your emotions, etc., 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 etc. So he was describing the limits of those two forms of psychoanalysis, and kind of so because he wanted to go back to like the spiritual thing, which is what matters to him the most, right? But obviously had some problems as a quote unquote guru. Anyway, that's just to say, I'm wondering about the connection with like, what if that's part of Lacan's insight is like, okay, these things are being co-opted and psychologized and they work on a very limited, you know, in a very limited way. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it does. I mean, I think that there is this concern with the, I guess in Zizekian terms is like the, because there's a lack in the big other. And I think this uniquely applies to the spaces that you're interested in, like with figures like Gurdjieff and others, you know, figures like Osho, is that because there's no big other, that it's easy for people to exploit that space of the guru.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy for people to pretend, to LARP, to manipulate in that space. And specifically what's going on in the manipulation, the exploitation of this space is the space of transference, is the space of emotional, you know, you're dealing with people oftentimes who are whether they're on a spiritual search, whether they're just looking for some mental health, concerns about their mental health. You're often dealing with people who are in an incredibly vulnerable space.
Yeah.
And so the possibility for malpractice and the possibility for abuse is quite high. I did want to quickly refer to what you were saying, Sweeney, earlier about, can you give specific examples of what Lacan's talking about?
Mm-hmm.
I can do it very quickly. So there were three major, so basically after Freud died, there was this association called the International Psychoanalytic Association, the IPA, which is still in existence today. And there were three major schools that had developed, and Lacan goes after each of them in turn. And basically, I can go through each of those schools. So there's the ego psychology school, which was basically trying to normalize the idea of a healthy ego. And Lacan took issue with this because he said, if you actually pay attention to how we should define the ego in Freud's original terms, is that the ego is, on the one hand, on the level of the imaginary. The ego is just imaginary, which it would make sense in mystical traditions, I think, as well.
Mm-hmm.
But the ego is nothing but frustration. So it's just, the ego is a result of frustration. And I could go into Lacan's theory about why that is and stuff like that. Mostly it's about the original impotence of the body, how we're born in a body which is impotent, can't do anything. And the ego is in some sense a reaction formation to this impotent body for Lacan. But the idea of a healthy ego is a contradiction in terms for him. So that's the first thing.
That's great. Yeah, that's true. Sorry.
The second thing is that there was the Kleinian school, and
can you explain that? Because in my understanding, the frustration of the ego comes, and I may be wrong, because it always has to mediate between the super id and the super ego and the id, and this is like a situation where you can't be happy, because on the other side, you are able to do some things with your body. Mm-hmm. You can fuck. You can eat. You can roll stones up the hill and do it again and again and again. So there are some things that you can do. So,
yeah. I was just going to say that, yeah, I mean, I do often conceptualize the ego myself as sometimes caught between a rock and a hard place, between the superego and the id.
Right.
There is a way in which the ego, I suppose if we were going to play with the word healthy ego, I would say that the ego's best function is to work with the contradictions of the id and the superego. Mm-hmm. But what he was against was this idea that the ego was somehow strong and healthy on its own.
Right.
Could basically, what he was against was the idea that the ego could dictate the terms of the id, or overcome the id, or mature the id, you know, like, or as it were, or as it were, be totally conscious of the superego. It's like, this is these are not possible things for Lacan. Is that it's always kind of a contradiction, the ego. And I guess that's how I try to think about the ego, is I try to fight against my ego to work with contradiction.
Right.
That's one way to think about it. So the Kleinian school, now this might be interesting to you guys, is the Kleinian school, Lacan had a lot of sympathies with the Kleinian school, because it wasn't so much focused on the ego, it was more focused on bodily drives, and Lacan was sympathetic to that. However, he thought the Kleinian school was too focused on the child-mother relationship, and at the expense of the importance of paternal normativity or paternal function. So in some sense, the bias there is actually, and we could talk about the way in which the Kleinian school had an over-dominant relationship of the child's drive body and its image-based attachment with the mother, and neglected the importance of a broadly speaking, a symbolic function to, let's say, liberate towards individuation.
Are you talking about Melanie Klein, right?
Yes.
Right. Okay. Mm-hmm.
So Melanie Klein was basically, and again, Lacan's very sympathetic to a lot of Klein's work, and there is a lot of great Kleinian scholarship. he's just, his critique here is, again, going back to the relationship between the imaginary and the symbolic. He's saying that the school is grounded too much in image-based childlike image-based attachments of the drive body with the mother. And it's not processing the negative emotions, the negative affects that will be required to assume a symbolic function in the world, basically to grow up. And that's more linked to, of course, paternal normativity, and processing the Oedipal complex. And, you know, a lot of what Lacan's trying to do is work through developmentally the Oedipal complex, not to reify the Oedipal complex as a final or eternal structure, but to accept that there is a certain relationship between the masculine and the feminine, which the child needs to process and
right. Assume. So the Klein school was too based in the mother; it was too feminine, so to speak, and that would, this lack of masculine principle.
Yeah, and for Lacan, that would be mostly articulated with the relation between the imaginary and the symbolic.
Hmm. Can you unpack that a bit? I'm not sure I'm getting it.
Well, the imaginary is basically the in regards to the feminine and the masculine, it's I'm always skeptical to just put a complete overlap between the feminine is imaginary and the masculine is symbolic. Although there is some truth to that, it seems to me, because the feminine does play up the image. The feminine does, in some sense, rely on the image as, for example, masquerade. Mm-hmm. Whereas the masculine does rely on narrative. It does rely on symbolic articulation. Yeah. So the basic idea there, as it relates to the overdominance of the image, is basically, in moving from the image to the symbolic, there's a lot of negative affects as it relates to detachment from your original fixations, right? So you have this, the baby had, so going back to this idea that we're born in an impotent body, and the baby's totally dependent on the mother, and the baby will develop imaginary fixations, partial fixations on the mother. The mother's breast, the mother's body, being held by the mother, being cared for by the mother. If I cry, all these infantile affects being immediately met by the mother. He's saying all of these images of wholeness, basically, because those are basically the images of the mother. The mother is the whole body of the mother, right? The imaginary fusion with the mother. That there's something of a symbolic function which the child needs to get a distance from the mother. And he's very critical of the mother in some sense. He likens the mother famously to a crocodile, and that the, in some sense, with the jaws very tightly wrapped around the child, and that the child struggles to individuate in part because of the mother's desire and the question of the mother's desire. Does the mother really want the child to individuate? And the child struggles with this, yeah. Right? And then in regards to the symbolic function, it's basically assuming a certain way of dealing with the lack of the all of the mother, right? So there's different mechanisms. We could talk about repression. We could talk about foreclosure. We could talk about disavowal. These are different symbolic mechanisms which the mind will develop in order to develop a detachment from that original motherly body, right? Like repression would be, you can't just have an immediate ecstatic sexual enjoyment with the feminine body, right? All the time. You can't do that. For example, and in some sense, the symbolic function. So let me just bring that maybe closer to home, is like, what do I do? Well, I'm building a philosophy platform. Well, what are you guys doing? You're developing a parallax education platform and a podcast, right? These are symbolic functions, right? And these symbolic functions, in order to work, they need sort of to be, let's say, all of our childish emotions need to, in some sense, be accounted for and sublimated into the symbolic function. Or else it would threaten the drive of the symbolic function itself. So this would be the type of thing that Lacan's looking to emphasize in analysis, is that we create an analytic situation where we're not trying to reify the relationship between the child mother-like attachment. We're trying to help the subject become assume a symbolic function in the world. Then finally, there's the object relation school. And basically the object relation school focus on the subject's relationship to an object. It could be an object, and let's say first and foremost, it's an object of genital love. The first boyfriend, the first girlfriend, your intimate partner, your marriage partner, or many partners, right? An object of genital love. And the problem Lacan had with the object relations theory is that it posited too much the possibility of a perfect harmony or a resolution with the object of genital love. And Lacan was saying, no, there is no possibility of perfect harmony and resolution with the genital object. And at the same time, what's at stake in that is the capacity to be in intimate relationship under the condition that it will always be imperfect. It will always be not a perfect harmony. And how do we deal with that? How do we work through, let's say, the tensions and vicissitudes of our object relations in that level?
Is that a segue to the real, in a sense?
Yeah, totally. Totally. So yeah, that's totally right. So you have this image-based attachment to the original object of affection. Mm-hmm. You have the immersion, you have the acceptance that you are a being in language. You have to be in language. You can't get out of that. You have to assume some sort of symbolic function. And what's at stake in assuming that symbolic function is a confrontation with the real. That the real is always going to be imperfect. The real is always going to be, there's always going to be disturbances that your symbolic function will have to confront in order to maintain the drive. And that's basically like that. I mean, that's a pretty concise picture of what's going on here, at least as I read it.
Mm-hmm. The one question I have, I think I'm getting the symbolic. What I'm not getting that well is why the feminine is associated with the imaginary.
Well, I'm saying that's questionable. I don't think we need to create a complete overlap or one-on-one synergy between the imaginary and the feminine, or the symbolic and the masculine, although it's tempting and easy to make those connections.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like the example I would give is the way in which the feminine dresses itself up, creates an image of itself, right? Like going out on a date or...
Why the hesitation there? Because I noticed that people don't like to talk about the masculine and the feminine because they're afraid of reductionism.
Yeah,
you know, in some kind of way, but I notice that it's there. You know, it's, you can't deny it. You can't deny that, you know, that the men are hyperconceptual, you know, tend to be hyperconceptual, and that women tend to
absolutely.
Be more, you know.
I mean, can you, because like in my personal conversations I have, which are, you know, with friends. And so when we talk about the difference between men and women, let's stay in the profane here. So I always notice that women are way more engulfed in storytelling than we men are. So if a woman has a certain story about what life is, and either you're in or you're out, you're participating in her story or you don't. While men are way more visually oriented and way more, you know, vision oriented, like also in terms of goals and everything. And so
I think you brought it up. I think you brought it up. I think that, you know, the examples I've heard you talk about before on the podcast is, you know, we're talking about those studies on pornography where men are attracted to the vision, the image, and women are they have the romance fiction.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, they're right, are interested in the experience or immediate or something like
Sweeney.
That. Yeah.
This is why we can't collapse the symbolic and the imaginary with the masculine and feminine, is because obviously men and women are both.
Yeah.
But it's just that I think men and women normatively, men and women have different relationships to both. Whereas, like, for example, men are visual in the sense that we're attracted to the vision, but the way in which we enact that vision is through being hyperconceptual, the narrative, the symbolic. Mm-hmm. Whereas women put on the image, but they're captured by the story. They're captured by the narrative. Right. Mm-hmm. So we have, so there's, in, of course, the imaginary symbolic works for both, but in different ways, it seems.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask a general question? Just as
to, and we, I just, and we all have the real, of course.
Yeah.
So when, like 15 minutes ago, you were talking about the, I think you used the word knowability in psychoanalysis. So when do we know something is true, right? When is something a real phenomenon, basically? And so I was wondering what Lacan says to this, because you're always, you know, you have these three categories. When do we know, for example, that woman as a crocodile is a phenomenon? Does Lacan offer some form of meta analysis about how he comes to these concepts, or how to deal with the kind of arbitrariness of these concepts?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So some interesting things. I mean, the two main ways, as far as I'm aware, that Lacan's developing these ideas is, on the one hand, directly from the speech of the analytic clinic itself, directly from the speech of subjects who are coming to analysis. On the other hand, it's also obviously clear that Lacan is exceptionally well-read, and he's also playing with philosophical concepts, and he's playing with concepts from literature as well. And so he seems to be using the analytic clinic to reinvent philosophical and literary concepts. That's what it seems to me that he's doing. Now, one of the interesting things he does in his writing a lot, like the woman as a crocodile, or he'll also call like the symbolic position of the king as like an ostrich with his head in the sand, which I think is a pretty powerful, funny image. He'll use a lot of organic metaphors, like the crocodile, like the ostrich.
Right.
Right. He'll use a lot of organic metaphors, which seem to me to have a certain punch or a certain hit. Now, what is the real of these metaphors? You know, do we need to take these metaphors super seriously? I think obviously he's trying to invoke a certain powerful image with the idea of woman as a crocodile. Do we need to say, oh, women are crocodiles now? No, that would be silly. But what we're trying to get at with that image is the idea of basically the Oedipal clink, the devouring mother, right? Like, I don't know if Jung used that term as well.
Vagina dentata or what?
Right. I mean,
Mm-hmm.
Right. I mean, these are terms that I'm sure appear in mystical and ancient knowledge as well. I mean, in some sense, he's probably just doing something that ancient thinkers already did, was use these types of metaphors to articulate a phenomenon which was difficult to pin down.
Well, I'm interested in sort of, I mean, our friend Thomas Helmerich has suggested that Lacan has a tantric quality to him.
Definitely.
In other words, it's a provocative kind of style, which it isn't, you know, literalist. maybe the problem with how people approach Lacan, or how people approach a lot of thinkers, is in a very literal way, and not being able to they hear something like the woman is a crocodile, and then they start to attach political offense to that, or something like, you know what I mean? So what about Lacan as having this, let's say, poetic, tantric, provocative quality?
Yeah. I mean, I totally think Lacan is a tantric figure. Like if I was to juxtapose Lacan and Freud, I mean, I would say Freud is the sutra.
Yeah.
For Lacan's tantra. I mean, and that's very apparent in his writing, is that Lacan's saying, look, I'm kind of a crazy guy. He's literally saying, I'm interested in psychosis. Like, Lacan's like, he's like, I'm not really as interested in, he said, of course he's interested in neurosis, but he's mostly focused on psychosis as his personal motivation. And he's emphasizing, we need to read Freud. So he's like, that's the sutra.
Okay.
You know, so then it's clear Lacan is the tantra. And to me, one of the tantric qualities is being unrepeatable, right? Being very difficult to mimic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like that's one of the principle. That's one of the qualities I think of the tantric is being
crazy difficult. Wisdom.
Crazy wisdom, right?
It can't be repeated. Yeah.
Absolutely. Can't be repeated. Very difficult to mimic.
Yeah.
And I think Lacan has that quality, and he actually embeds and embodies that quality in his work, which I've actually kind of tried to learn from a little bit, which is he had this principle. He never wanted to repeat himself. So he said everything in his seminars would just be contingent, spontaneous, organic coming out. And he never wanted to do the same lecture again and again. He's going to give a lecture once and it could be transcribed. You can look at the seminar, whatever, but he's never going to do it again.
That's Miles Davis was like that. He never played his old stuff. He never ever played, you know, played tonal jazz after when he was doing jazz fusion. He refused to go back to his old material. Very few people do that.
Yeah. So he is kind of like a jazz musician, in that sense.
Is he a better orator than he's a writer? Or like, A lot of people say that.
A lot of people say that he was his. So a lot of people treat the seminars, which are the oral materials, with more seriousness than they treat the accrete, which is the writing materials.
Which is a weird phenomenon, because it's like, I mean, the same phenomenon is kind of true for Peterson, who is like way better orator than he's a writer. And I presume, and that's just my thinking, my imagination, but I think also Hegel was a better orator than it was a writer, you know, because he was like so under stress with writing. He had to finish the manuscripts. And so, but he probably was very captivating in the seminars. You know,
there's funny jokes, right? I mean, you're probably aware of the funny jokes about the relationship between Schopenhauer and Hegel, where Schopenhauer would have one person show up at his lecture and everyone would be at Hegel's lectures.
Exactly.
So there was a way in which people were captivated. There's certainly Hegel, if Hegel was giving a lecture, it was kind of the talk of the town.
Exactly.
And in the same way with Lacan. If Lacan's giving a lecture, it's kind of the talk of the town. And you could say the same thing about guys like Peterson. I would also say guys like Žižek, right? Like, I think Žižek is a great, he's a great performer, right? Peterson, and of course, everyone has different styles, right? But I think there's an objectivity of being a good performer, an entertaining performer.
Yeah.
Well, I was thinking when you were talking about his transformation of being sort of an elitist, you know, philosopher and having a niche group to being a popular figure in the 60s, I was thinking there's something kind of guru-like about Lacan.
Definitely.
And I felt that when people have been talking about him to me, they get very excited and they get kind of like passionate about Lacan. And I don't necessarily understand it because I don't know the language. So I feel like it's an esoteric world that they're trying to communicate to me. And when they talk about desire and things like that, and the petite object, or whatever the fuck that is.
I think there's no question that Lacan's work is kind of like a liturgy. Right. Like there's something theological about Lacan's work.
Okay. Does it work as a liturgy finally?
Well, I think internal to the Lacanian psychoanalytic community, that might be how it like people will just read the, and Lacan was trying to, also leave us with algebra. He's trying to apply algebraic symbols and mathematical equations to the mind, and leaving us with these formulas. Like, he has formulas of sexuation. He has the formulas of the barred subject and the object cause of desire. All of these formulas are, when you just understand the algebra of it, are very, very simple and very, very powerful. And it's very, very hard to see subjectivity or understand discursive relations outside of these algebraic equations. That's fair enough. It's a very real thing that happens to a lot of people who study Lacan.
But what was his relationship with religion, basically? Because, I mean,
Peterson... Very complex. His brother was a Catholic priest.
Hmm.
He was raised Catholic. He was, throughout his writings, self-identified as an atheist. However, his respect and use of religion throughout his work is plain as day. He's always referring to biblical imagery and literature.
Right.
He refers very lovingly to figures like Saint Paul, to of course Christ. He engages Buddhism as well. I will say that he did write a text on the triumph of religion at the end of his life, and he predicted that Catholicism would win the day over psychoanalysis.
Is that happening?
I don't know. I don't. Next question. I don't. Yeah. I don't know if that's actually happening, and I actually don't. I don't subscribe to the idea that like the last things a great thinker leaves us are like some supreme wisdom. Like, oh, what did he say on his deathbed? Or like, what did he say? Right. Like, it could also just be senile rantings at the end of his life.
All right.
Right. Yeah. But like, I actually like to go to the. To the actually like what I see is like the dense core of like the middle of someone's career.
Well, there's an insight there that I think is true, and that is that religion is more powerful than anything. That's kind of my view, that it overwhelms all these other things that come along.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's hyper fascinating, and I would be very interested to talk about this at length if you guys are up for it, but it does seem to me, and Lacan will talk about this, that psychoanalysis in comparison to religion is incredibly fragile and in some sense impotent. And religion does seem to appeal to even to such a deep part of us that even Lacanian analysts can be like religious figures. So, you know, what is the ultimate relationship between psychoanalysis and religion? What is the ultimate destiny of the future of our religions? I think it's a totally open question.
What about the difference between psychoanalysis and psychotherapy?
Right. So I think the main distinction there is in regards to some of the theories about transference and the image. It seems like a lot of psychotherapy is grounded in self-help and kind of trying to normativize an idea of health. And also psychotherapy seems like I've listened to, like, for example, some people who've gone to psychotherapy, and I talk to them about what's actually going on in psychotherapy and so forth. It seems to be almost like, to me, it seems to be almost like a baby soother for the ego. Like where they just, like, what are you struggling with?
You're trying to feel okay.
Trying to feel okay. Yeah, yeah. Whereas psychoanalysis, if it's grounded properly, is about the negativities of transference. And it's about you're not going to go in there and get your ego validated.
Yeah, right.
You're going to go into psychoanalysis and basically your ego is going to be dissolved. That's the point.
So it's on the threshold of religion in a way. That's kind of what I'm getting here.
How can the ego be resolved?
Dissolved.
Dissolved.
How can that be the case if it's a mediator between these two other forces?
Well, I mean, it's like, there we get into like, I mean, here we get into very weird territory, because ultimately, if the ego is this frustrated image, which is kind of like an effect of separation and the desire therein constituted by separation, it seems to me like in the transition from desire to drive, the ego is kind of dissolved. It's kind of like there's no ego there anymore. And what is mediating then? What is the mediator of contradiction? Could you just say the self?
Right.
Could you, I don't know, like I'm open here, but like, is there a meaningful distinction here between the ego and the self?
The way I think of it is the ego becomes transparent to itself. So,
right.
So it doesn't go away. I think the destruction of the ego, cause it kind of has a function. It just becomes subsumed within a larger framework.
I think
that's how I see it, or it becomes, you can, like in the tantric tradition, you would say you wear it as an ornament. You know, it's not you.
Right. I mean, I think the way, at least in which Lacan described it in a certain passage, which I thought was quite powerful, was that what's going on in analysis is that the ego is kind of this, it's actually, there's an image, there's an unconscious image, which is structuring all of your behavior. And this image comes from the first years of your life. It originates in the first years of your life. And making this as more reflexively, becoming more reflexively aware of this image, in some sense, determining and dictating your life, has a opens up the possibility for a perspectival shift, maybe quite similar to what you were describing there, Sweeney, with using the ego as more of an ornament.
Yeah. And there's a transparency rather than
a transparency.
Being blindly guided by something, you know, kind of in a mechanical way, like by something, by drives and whatnot.
Okay, I have another question. So it's a little bit off topic, but I have a feeling that way more, like, less people than claim to have read Hegel and Lacan actually have read those two people. And I think you are the one of the few that have actually dug into both of them, right? So
I'm not trying to fool anyone. I actually have read these figures.
Right. And so no, it's like, but I think the actual amount of people who have read The Science of Logic, it's very, very small. Very small. So the question for the audience is how do you read Lacan and Hegel so that it becomes approachable? How do you approach a text if you had to explain what you're doing?
Well, I mean, in some sense, I'm doing what I'm... So, long story short, I was in my doctoral program and I was deeply unsatisfied with the cognitive science I was learning, the complexity science I was learning, in regards to the personal affective dimensions of my life personally. And I was exploring philosophy. And I stumbled upon Zizek's work. And I quickly realized the method Zizek was using was a combination of Hegel and Lacan. And so I basically dedicated myself from there to learning the foundations of those thinkers. And the reason why I think those thinkers are important is because precisely they speak to the dialectics of knowledge and the unconscious mind. Those are the two concrete. And so ultimately, I don't think everyone needs to read these figures, but I think it's incredibly useful, however you get into this realm, is to take seriously the dialectics of knowledge, and which is to keep your knowledge flexible, but at the same time, paradoxically structured logically. But the content is flexible.
But can you be more precise? Because these texts are famously opaque.
Right, so I'm trying. Like, if I was to try to be the simplest possible, it would be. It's very important that we build an educational system which includes dialectical structure of knowledge and includes the unconscious mind as integral for the future of social life and development.
I mean, like, more precise. What do you do to read The Science of Logic? Do you go from A to B to Z?
So if people are interested in reading,
right.
Oh, so if people are interested in reading, I always emphasize active reading. Like, I always give the Nietzschean metaphor of a lion with a gazelle. Like, if you're not a lion with a gazelle, like a hungry lion chasing a gazelle,
sure,
you're not reading it right.
Right.
In my view, you have to be an active reader. So there has to be an a priori passion there to get into this stuff. If you're not a priori willing to go through it, because it's going to be like, I actually gave myself health complications teaching The Science of Logic. I developed an eye problem. Like, it's only recently gone away.
Right.
So like, it's like, to actually go into this stuff fully, like, I spent 5 years with the phenomenology of spirit. I had to take certain breaks because it was too much. This is a sacrifice.
You have to make a sacrifice. You have to make a sacrifice. Yeah.
You have to make, yeah. And you have, so if you're willing,
so
to
you became basically Odin, huh?
if you're willing to make that sacrifice, then you have to be an active reader. And I would say what that means is that I never just read. Like, I'm just sitting there with a book reading. I'm always also typing and creating images.
Like, right? Literal, so I've images. Got, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like I'll make images in PowerPoint, which become presentations.
Right.
And note
not afterwards while you're reading. You don't read
while
it
I'm reading.
Once
it's
first,
all together.
You're doing it like the first thing, or do you read it first and then go back?
I've got two slides open on my computer all the time. One with the text, and the other with the creative medium I'm using to bring out the text in a way that helps me make sense of it in a deeper sense.
Mm-hmm.
Because if I'm just reading. Most of, like, if I don't know if you pay attention to this, but like if you're reading a paragraph of something very dense and complex, it's like you can read it and then you're like, what did I just read? Like, it just, like, you know, you forget it. Like, not all the information sinks in. So, like, to me, what helps the information sink in is if I'm also typing about it, writing notes about it at the same time.
Yeah. Well, I do find that it, like, if I really want to get to know a text very well, I have to write about it.
Yes,
that I can't just read it. Otherwise, I just get an abstract, vague version of the text that I'm reading.
There's a great
if it's a complex and difficult text, not just a narrative or a story. Or
there's a great there's a great Theory Underground article about the ethics of our engagement with these liminal web spaces and philosophy and knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And here's his principle, and I like it: is in this order, we read, we write. Then we talk, right? Sure. Most people skip to the talking, right? Yeah. Like, imagine you haven't read a certain thinker, right? Like, I haven't read certain thinkers that you've read, so I won't talk on it because I haven't read it. So you read it, you write about it, then you talk about it.
Right.
Yeah. That's on the other hand, that's what we're doing here because me and Tom have not gone through the Zikrete, but I think that you can't read everything.
You can't.
So it's okay to get insights from Lacan here and there if you're not a Lacanian, and even if you're focused on something else. Like, it's good to talk to you about this, even if I might not be willing to make the great sacrifice at this moment to read Lacan.
Absolutely. So I think that, like, on that point is that, like, I hope that I embody this, but if I don't, it's something that I strive to embody is, if I haven't read a certain thinker, but I can learn from someone who has read a certain thinker, to just have the disposition of a certain humbleness or a certain, I don't know about many thinkers, right? And someone else, like, I haven't read Gurdjieff, for example. Yeah.
Right? Well, we might have opinions. It's too easy to have opinions about things, right?
It's very easy.
And you can pick
opinions.
Up all these opinions because you're part of this kind of egregore of opinion and, you know, in cyberspace. Sure. And so you have this opinion, but that's too easy. Yeah, I think that's right.
But Cadell, so how much does temperament play into the whole kind of thing? Because, I mean, there are obviously different types of approaches to language. I mean, it's for me, basically, it's very easy to read Luhmann, right? It just registrates everything because I like the language. And then I take a different author from the same era, Habermas, and it's just like horrible,
you know,
and I really have, you know, no, it's like, I have to really work with it. It's not, it's not my language, but I can cherish Habermas nonetheless, but it's a different language. And so you have to have a certain temperament and a certain inclination to language. You like that kind of approach and not that one. So I would presume you have to have an inclination towards Lacan and Hegel, you know, to that.
I think so.
Yeah. Hmm.
I think so. I think that goes back to that a priori disposition, like, and this is an ineffable, in some sense, ineffable dimension of our, and maybe even a dimension of madness internal to us all is, you know, why do we gravitate towards the thinkers and the people that we gravitate towards? Why do we gravitate away from other people? Why are you attracted to Luhmann but not Habermas? Why am I attracted more to, like, in my doctorate, for example, I studied both Zizek's cortex and Sloterdijk's cortex. And I just personally, emotionally, for whatever reason, stylistically, I gravitate toward Žižek.
It's so fascinating for me. Yeah. I've read everything from Sloterdijk. It's just pure poetry for me.
Right. There you go. Right. So this yeah.
is you're German.
But why, so is, why that? Is that? I don't. But here I don't have an answer why. But I think we need to love that anyway. Because why we need to love that is because how boring would it be if you and I both are just oh yeah Sloterdijk. But what's more interesting is let's talk about Žižek and Sloterdijk.
Right. Right.
It creates something interesting.
Right, that's true. Mm-hmm.
Right, so mm-hmm. it's more interesting to have that difference than to have everyone homogenized.
No, yeah, absolutely. I'm just always constantly intrigued by this. I don't know if it's inborn, where it comes from, if it's conditioning, what this kind of tendency to certain themes, to certain languages, to certain imagery.
I think it's like the desire of the other, like. Like there's something about Žižek's style that for whatever reason evokes desire in me.
Yeah.
Right.
And there might be something about Sloterdijk's style that evokes desire in you for that way of thinking.
I know in my 20s, I read everything of Henry Miller, you know, it was kind of sexy writing too, but then I had to read everything that Henry Miller read. Like I had to read Agnes Nin, and I had to read all the people that Henry Miller knew and read, and I had to read Dostoevsky, and I had to read D.H. Lawrence, because these are all the guys that Henry Miller was reading. So I couldn't just read Henry Miller. I had to completely devour his entire universe. And then
yeah, that's a good way of saying.
And then when I started to write, I was writing shitty Henry Miller style prose because I was a fucking imitator. I couldn't do it.
So
I think you have to devour the writer in a sense to the level of possession. Yeah. And then at certain
and
point,
then be like, depossessed.
Now I've kind of left that behind because it's not really where I'm at right now. You know, not because I made a decision to leave it behind. It kind of left me or it's a very interesting process, but I think it's possession in a way. So it is desire and it's not something reasonable and
no.
nor should it be, you know.
No,
yeah.
It's madness.
It's madness for sure.
I think I like the way you were putting that about devouring Henry Miller and that possession. And then that leads to the imitation, of course. And so I think that's something that I'm trying to teach as well at Philosophy Portal. And also something I'm trying to cultivate in myself is that even though I'm inspired by these thinkers, I want my writing to be distinct, right, from them. And so I try to keep my own style. And also I think where at least for me, I sort of bring something unique to the table is that my background is primarily in science. Like my undergrad, my graduate school, and my doctoral training are all science. I didn't ever take a philosophy class. So I think that's very unique because I can bring my scientific background to these philosophers. And I think that in some sense, it allows me to be more clear than someone like Žižek, who can be very all over the place.
Yeah.
Because he's more literary, or he has a more literary nature. It kind of reminds me of music too, in the sense that I couldn't study music in university. I could only do it outside of university, whenever I studied music in university. So that brought me another perspective on music. Whereas, so often if you're an outsider to your own field, you have a more powerful perspective on that.
That's right.
Yeah.
I think that's crucial. I remember studying people who were specifically that category, as people who became people who innovated precisely because they were outsiders to the field that they innovated in.
Right.
Yep. So like there was a guy I sort of looked up to at one point. His name was Aubrey de Grey, who's technically a gerontologist now. He developed ideas about the aging process, but he was originally a computer scientist. He didn't study biology. And then he went into the field of biology from computer science and he reinvented the field of aging. But this type of thing can happen all the time.
I mean, Wilbur studied biology as far as I
Wilbur as well. He wasn't really, Wilbur wasn't really.
In Lacan's case, he was a psychiatrist who invaded the field of psychoanalysis from psychiatry.
Mm.
And also he had a powerful theological background too, I think, right?
Yeah, powerful theological and philosophical background. He studied a lot of Descartes. He studied a lot of Spinoza. He studied the ancients. He studied a lot of literature. He said if it wasn't for some dumb luck, he would have been like an English teacher or something like that.
So guys, I'm going to have to wrap this up soon because I have to get out of here.
Cadel, you want to have some last words in regard of your course? When does it start again?
Yeah, thanks. The course starts September 3rd. I'm really looking forward to it throughout the fall. Basically, if you have Sunday evenings free, Sunday evenings in the fall, then this, and you're also interested in learning about psychoanalysis and you're have some interest piqued about specifically Lacan's work, this is definitely the place for you. So every Sunday evening will be lectures, 13 lectures, which cover the entirety of the accrue. But we also have other features of the course, which I think are incredibly important. There will be 4 guest lecturers, Isabel Millar, Peter Rollins, Richard Boothby, Todd McGowan, who are all experts in the field in a different way and have been developing ideas with me throughout the entire year. We've led seminars for the accrue, and the seminars for the accrue are freely available on my YouTube channel, but all of these thinkers will be developing these ideas. They're just introductory pieces. So they're going to be developing these ideas in the course. We're also going to have exegetical reading spaces, which are going to highlight the most important passages in the accrue, and there'll be spaces where I'm not there, which are led by Dimitri Kroymans, who will take control of that space. And as all the courses, they're organized towards creative participation. So there'll be a conference and an anthology process. So if you're interested in not only learning, but also creating with this in a community context, then philosophyportal.online/theaccrue or email me and would be happy to have you involved.
Fantastic. Thanks a lot, Cadel. And Cadel is really doing, let's say, living philosophy. It's not merely academic.
I try. I appreciate that, Sweeney, as well. And as always, I love this podcast. I always tune into this podcast and love the work at Parallax.